welcome you to tonight's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Acts legislation details. Thank you so much for joining us, and let me introduce our guest speaker tonight. Starting tonight will be CCL's Vice President of Government Affairs, Dr. Danny Richter. Danny joined CCL staff in 2013 as the first staffer in DC. He established that office where he's been responsible for developing our overall legislative strategy, clarifying the details of our policy that we'll talk about tonight after a long-awaited for arrival, and overseeing our research program as well that he can speak to. If we've done our job well, after the end, all attendees should be able to have the following goals met: understanding the broad outlines of the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, understanding the broader strategy behind this bill. So to kick us off, I will pass it to Danny, who will be going over the carbon fee and dividend components of the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, as well as the carbon equalization tariff. Following that, the regulatory adjustment questions that we've gotten ahead of time, we'll make sure to get especially in depth on that, as well as some other key strategic considerations that folks have been asking about. And then we'll get to the questions that have been submitted but haven't gotten to in this presentation. So with that, sit back, relax, continue to use that chat window to participate, and I'll pass it to you, Danny, to start kicking us off.
All right. Thank you very much, Brett, and thank you, everybody, for taking the time to educate yourself further on this bill. So let's begin with an update. We added a new co-sponsor today. So the bill was introduced with three Democrats and two Republicans, and today we added Dave Trott, who is a Republican out of Michigan. He is a co-sponsor. So right now we have two Democrats who are coming back, two Republicans who are coming back, and one Democrat and one Republican who retired, who will not be coming back in the next Congress. So that's super great. We're really glad that we were able to get that bipartisan introduction and keep it even. So we're going to be going through the four components of this bill, and we're going to start with the carbon fee. And this, remember, this is what drives the emissions reductions. So this is where you get the emissions reductions. And just like the CCL bill, the fee on CO2 equivalents, so not just CO2, but other greenhouse gases that come from fossil fuels and from fluorinated greenhouse gases, starts at $15 per metric ton. It increases by at least $10 per ton per year. And there is an environmental integrity mechanism. And so I said at least $10 per ton per year. There is a schedule for emissions reductions going down to a 90% reduction below 2015 levels by 2050. And basically, if it's not $10, it's $15. If any given year we are not meeting the goal for that year in terms of cumulative emissions, then the fee will go up by $15 instead of $10. So that's what's known as an environmental integrity mechanism. Fluorinated gases are also covered, but covered at 10% of the global warming potential of that fluorinated gas. We feel good about that. Spain, for example, they put a fee on fluorinated gases in their country, and in one year, they saw a 50% reduction in those fluorinated gases. So we feel like we can get the emissions reductions we need without a higher price, and so we feel very good about that. There is an exemption for agricultural uses and non-emissive uses. So non-emissive uses would be like asphalt or plastics. That's carbon that's not going to end up in the atmosphere, so there's a rebate for those. For the agricultural use, remember, this was a negotiated bill. And so in the negotiations, it was decided that farmers who buy on a retail market but sell on a commodities market, the price takers, not price makers, there was a real burden for them. And so there was an exemption for agricultural fuels built into the bill, so they don't have quite the same burden. And so that's in the bill. We also feel good about that We believe those fuels which would be exempt account for about 0.6% of the United States emissions. And we feel like that does not erode the overall integrity of the program. So we feel good about that. There, again, the target is a 90% reduction below 2015 levels by 2050. 2015 levels are about 1990 levels. And in the fourth assessment report of the IPCC is the last one that broke up developed countries. That is about midway between the range. The range they provided for developed countries like the United States was 80 to 95%. So this is the same as our policy. We divided by two. We divided that in half. That gives you 87.5. We rounded up to a round number. Give ourselves some cushion, 90% below 2015 by 2050. There was also a sunset clause, which I think is interesting. This clause basically says what I've been saying in Republican offices anyway. This is wean off and then wean on and then wean off. Gradually rising price. Once we hit that 90% reduction target, there's no more price rise. The price is fixed there. And at that point, we were really low on fossil fuels. And as we continue to go off of fossil fuels, the dividend goes lower and lower and lower. And the sunset clause says, number one, once we reach that 90 degree below 2015 emissions target, and once the monthly dividend is 20 inflation adjusted dollars or less, then the program for 3 years, then the program goes away. This is important because it enables folks who are concerned about the size of government to say, this doesn't really go to the size of government. It's intended to do one thing, do it well, and then go away. This is not a new entitlement. Entitlements don't go away. They don't have a self-destruct mechanism. So that's the sunset clause. There is a rebate for safe and permanent carbon capture and sequestration. So from covered fuels. So if you are burning a fuel that was subject to the fee, and you can safely and permanently sequester that carbon dioxide, then you can get a rebate for the CO2, which is likely to stay underground. And that's what that is. There was another provision for agriculture there. The original size in the negotiation process was just to cover power plants, but we shrunk it so that it could also cover fertilizer plants. And it turns out the fertilizer is a closed loop process. So it captures CO2. And right now fertilizer manufacturers, they sell that to Coca-Cola. They sell it to oil companies. It's used into enhanced oil recovery. It ends up in your fizzy drinks. At a certain point, the rebate will be so high that it makes more sense for them to sequester that underground. And they should be able to make money off of that. So that should keep the price of fertilizer low. So that's the carbon fee. Now let's compare this to the IPCC special report on 1.5 degrees centigrade. How do we do? That, as we all know, covered marginal abatement costs in detail. And what we see here to the right, this is a modification of Rick Knight's IPCC summary from the November Education Day. There are two lines in there. The shorter line, the one that doesn't get the orange lines, the orange bars, that's a 2 degree centigrade target. The blue bars, that's a 1.5 degree target. And the lower line, the lower green line, that's what this bill does, because in this bill, we missed it. There's no inflation adjustment. There's no linking of the price increase to inflation. The higher dotted line does link it to inflation. We will be advocating for linking this to inflation, because as you can see, that gives us a fighting chance of making even the 1.5 degree target. Even without inflation, we're in the 2 degrees centigrade realm out to 2070, but some caveats here. So the IPCC assumed that this is the only policy mechanism that would be followed. And I don't know about you, but I think once this gets passed, I think it's extremely unlikely that out to 2070, this is the only thing that is reducing emissions. Another thing about these IPCC numbers is that they ignored policy-induced innovation. So what that means is they did not assume a greater rate of innovation by businesses, by governments, in terms of the technologies that result in lower emissions. And so that's conservative. So I would expect the price ranges for both those orange bars and those blue bars to be lower. I think this has a better shot. at making those targets, because the IPCC, as ever, is very conservative. Also, the other thing about IPCC, that was a global price, not country-specific, so there's not much we can do about there. It's just good to keep in mind that what they were talking about is a global price, and of course, the United States is one country. So that's the carbon fee. The carbon dividend, as you know, is to protect the poor and the middle class. And this is equal shares to all adults with a valid Social Security number, a tax identification number, and a half share to minors up to 19 years old. You'll notice there is not a two-child limit as there is in the CCL policy. So that is a change, that is a difference that evolved in the negotiation process. There's some other great things about the carbon dividend. There's a one-month prebate. So that means that the first dividend comes the month before the fee hits. So let's say that first dividend is $36. Over the next 3 years, that would be made up. So the next 36 payments, that's 3 years, is 12 times 3 is 36 months. Each of those would be $1 less. And so on a 10-year scoring period, it would still be revenue neutral. The other thing that makes this revenue neutral, according to the CBO, is the fact that it's taxable. Making it taxable also makes it more progressive, meaning that the poor do better because we do have a progressive income tax system. So making it taxable does make it, it makes it both revenue neutral and it makes it more progressive. And this would be administered by the Treasury. And so that's the carbon dividend. Some of the details, some of the impacts. It's statutory. The administrative costs are not to exceed 2%. So that's in the bill, and we feel good that will be honored. And some of the impacts of this, as you know, this is a figure from the household impact study. Bottom quintile, 86% do end up ahead outright. But we also know that these are conservative. So when Kevin Ummel did the study, he assumed 100% pass-through of costs. But you're still raising the same amount of revenue, which means you're still getting the same amount distributed. So if you assume a more realistic pass-through, say 87%, everybody is still getting the same dividend, but costs only go up by, say, 87% as much, which means that more people will end up ahead. So that's why the household impact study has always been a very conservative study. That 86% in the bottom quintile, 72% in the second quintile, those are rock bottom numbers. And let's look a little bit deeper at those in the low-income households. So just those who are below the federal poverty level. Here you have different groups. Minority households, 92% benefit. 99% families of four benefit. 81% of the elderly, and 91% of single-parent households. Again, this is just for those who are below the federal poverty level. And another thing, winners went big, losers lose small. This is also from household impacts. You see on the left-hand side, those who are 100% of the poverty line or less, this can amount to between 1% and 5% of their income. But as you get further out into the income scale, this is only about 0.2, 0.3% of their income. So people who are losing, they're really just not going to notice. It's not a big effect. So that's the carbon dividend. The carbon equalization tariff, this is just acknowledging, as we always have, this is taking a global view for a global problem. There is mirrored consideration for fossil fuels, carbon-intensive goods. So that means that the border carbon equalization tariff is the same. So carbon-intensive goods, they have a fair and equivalent price for like goods levied on them as those like goods produced in the United States, and those goods that are exported from the United States, they have a rebate that is fair and equivalent to the tariff that is being put on goods coming in. For fossil fuels who are coming in, they have the fee placed on them. For fossil fuels that are leaving, and this is a difference from the CCL policy, the fee is rebated to those fossil fuels as they leave. This is designed for WTO compliance, and as we were shopping this around to offices, paragraph B in this section lifts directly from the WTO. So those of you who studied the CCL laser talk know that we cite Article 20, paragraphs B and G of the GATT, and we basically lifted that language and put it directly in this bill just to allow ourselves, if we don't meet national treatment or most favored nation, we still have this ability to levy a carbon equalization tariff to preserve plant, animal, human life, or conserve natural resources. But the best case is we never have to use this. it would be complicated. So there's language in the bill that says if a country has a equivalent price based only on a price, so not regulations, based on a cap, a fee, or a tax, then we can determine equivalence. And if via a multilateral or a bilateral treaty, those two countries have determined equivalence, then you don't have to do the carbon equalization tariff. And again, that is the best case scenario. Now, the last part of, there's one more part. These are all the countries that have a carbon price planned or in place. And you notice that this includes our biggest trading partners. So you have Canada, Mexico, European countries, Japan, South Korea, China. So we, our biggest trading partners are included in this. They're already trying to do something, trying to price carbon. So the regulatory adjustment, this was the price of bipartisanship. As we were going through this process, we began with the CCL text, and I started with what we've been selling to you. But it became very clear that in order to get Republicans on board, there had to be some sort of regulatory adjustment. And so here it is. The guiding principle of this was that there should be no double jeopardy. So if a business is incurring a cost due to regulations on their fossil fuel, either they can't incur a cost due to regulations and for the carbon fee. But it is also extremely narrow. It's a very narrow regulatory limitation. So first of all, let's cover the things that are protected. Regulations that remain protected, the EPA endangerment finding remains in place, the CAFE vehicle efficiency standards remain in place, the ability to issue a waiver from certain states like California also remains in place. The ability to regulate methane emissions from natural gas or petroleum systems remains in place because that is not going to be very well covered by the fee. The ability to regulate any greenhouse gas for impacts on health or welfare other than its greenhouse gas effects remains in place. So you can still regulate greenhouse gases that come off of fossil fuels for their health effects. So say if you're in a frontline community and say there's a natural gas plant that is leaking and that's having negative health effects, you can still regulate that. It's just that if you have a fossil fuel and you can, so let's say take coal. So let's apply this to coal. You can't regulate coal for the CO2 that is emitted when you burn that coal for its greenhouse gas effects. But you could still regulate that CO2 for its effects on ocean acidification. You could still regulate it based on the sulfur, based on the mercury, based on its effect on streams, based on its effects on particulates. And the other thing about all of this is that if we have not met the cumulative targets by 2030, these regulations, which are suspended, come back. And there's a reevaluation of how we're doing. Are we meeting those targets every 5 years? And if we're not meeting the cumulative targets, the regs come back. So this is a very, very limited regulatory adjustment. And I also want to put this in perspective. Let's look at the Clean Power Plan. So assuming that it was not suspended, right now the Clean Power Plan is not in effect. Let's be clear, and it won't come into effect because the Trump administration has already said we're going to rewrite it. And any president can do that. And so even if the 2016 election had gone otherwise, and even if a Democratic president won again in 2020, Clean Power Plan would not have come into effect until 2022. It would have had to survive pending legal challenges. And the targets are less than the Paris commitments. And when you look at this map, which came out of Michael Wara at Stanford, the highest price in the whole country for the Clean Power Plan, combined with the Clean Power Plan, was $39 in Rhode Island. We get that in year 3 or 4. So the Clean Power Plan it was a wonderful effort that was very well-intentioned, but it was created to be traded, and this is a trade worth making. So if Barack Obama said, "I have long believed that the most elegant way to drive innovation and reduce carbon emissions is to put a price on it." So he said this on December 4th of 2015 in Scientific American. Barack Obama, Lisa Jackson, the Clean Power Plan itself says that this policy, that the EICDA is more effective than the Clean Power Plan. So I will try and go slower for the strategic considerations. I am conscientious of time. We do like to stay on time. I want to get to a lot of questions. But number one, why introduce this in the lame duck? Number one, we want to give you a tool. We want to give you this tool. You've never had a bill that's been introduced that you can point to. We see it as very important over the next few months. We do want to reintroduce this early in the next Congress to go get sponsorships, co-sponsorships, endorsements is what we want. And so having a bill that you can point to is going to make, I think, a world of difference in terms of getting endorsements. The other thing is we wanted to, this to serve as an inoculation against growing partisanship. Already we're seeing growing partisanship between the two parties as we have a divided Congress. And this is a proof that the parties, the two parties, can get together and they can agree that we need to take big steps to address this problem. So people are still going to do things that make this a wedge issue, but this is a clear bridge between the parties. And the first time it was introduced forever, it will have been introduced in a bipartisan way. And that's a huge, huge, huge win. Yes, the plan is to reintroduce early in the next Congress, and the Senate. I think there's a misconception that CCL doesn't focus on the Senate, but in my eyes, we focus on the Senate just as much as we focus on the House. We have conversations going with senators. Having something in the House will move those conversations forward a lot more, and this is a reach for me. This is a reach goal, but what I would love to see is I would love to see a Senate companion bill introduced in time for our June lobby day. That is a reach, but that would be my goal.
The last thing, again, that I will highlight here is that if you do have questions, where we're going to route you to first is the main bill page on community. And from there, there's a Q&A, more in-depth FAQ section, as well as a forums. This forum is what we've put in the actual chat window a lot. I know that we've been trying to keep up with everyone. I think we've been doing a fairly good job with that. So feel free to put that question that you didn't get answered tonight or anything that emerges afterwards if you just forgot to ask something right there in Communities Forums. You can always email me as well, and I'll direct you to the right person or resource. My email is just brett@citizensclimate.org. But the biggest thing that we really wanted to close with, as always, but especially in this most historic of weeks, is thanking all of you on the line tonight. You are absolutely the reason why we are where we're at today and have gotten so far, and we really are excited to continue to work together to get this bill that's now been introduced over the next goalpost. So thank you for making it to tonight's CCU. We hope you found this webinar useful, and we'd love to make sure to continue to stay in touch.